I call this meeting of the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy to order. Thank you. There is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for Thursday, January the 31st?
So moved.
Wednesday. I'm sorry. Wednesday, January the 30th.
So moved for that.
All right. So Representative Freiburg moves approval of the minutes for Wednesday, January the 30th. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Do oppose? The motion prevails, and the minutes for Wednesday, January the 30th are approved. Okay, so let's see. So we have Representative Bonner, who is at the testifying table, ready to testify. Please go ahead and move your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 149 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee for on Commerce.
All right, so we have the bill before the committee, and Representative Bonner, I believe you also have an author amendment. Would you like to move that bill?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that we have the A1 amendment, which makes a technical correction and puts the bill in the proper format in which I wish to present it to the committee today.
Okay, the A1 amendment should be in your folder. So, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The A amendment is adopted. Representative Bonner, please present your bill.
All right, thank you. I am Representative Bonner, representing Maple Grove and Osseo, and I am here today to represent House File 149. This is a pretty simple and straightforward bill. Essentially, what it does is it removes the provision that is often put through in contracts from either providers or pharmacy benefit managers that prevents a pharmacist from telling a consumer when they could purchase their prescription for cheaper, either off the shelf or out of pocket, than their standard copay. A really good example to help illustrate this point for the body today is, for example, we here in Minnesota often suffer from seasonal affective disorder. That's fairly common, being with our long winters and the darkness. And one of the common ways to treat that condition is, of course, vitamin D tablets. Now, often your doctor will send over a series of prescriptions to the pharmacy in quick order, right? And the pharmacist is more than happy to oblige and fill those orders. And they can definitely put a one-month supply of vitamin D tablets into a jar and put your name on it. However, what they are not allowed to do at this time is to tell you that you could probably get that same jar of tablets for a 100-day supply, which is nearly 3 months, off of the shelf for about $5. And when we start thinking about how we take care of our seniors who might be impacted by this or our young families, those dollars can add up really quickly when you're on a fixed income or have very limited resources. So this is basically a bill to help put money back into the pockets of those who need it most.
So, Representative Bonner, I understand you have a testifier.
I do. Thank you. I have beside me Jeff
Lindu.
I want to make sure I say it correctly, who is a 40-year veteran, I believe. But I'll let him give you a little bit of his background and explain where he's coming from.
Well, welcome to the committee. Could you please identify yourself and tell us who you represent?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Lindu. I am a pharmacist, practiced in the state of Minnesota for 42 years. I'm recently retired. Practiced with a company called Thrifty White Pharmacy. If you're in the rural areas, you may be a little more familiar with that than here in the metro. It's an employee-owned company. based out of the Twin City area here. I am on behalf of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I first want to thank Representative Bonner and members of this committee for understanding and supporting community pharmacists and the patients that we serve. Today I'm here to support my to voice my support for HF 149, the prohibition of gagging the pharmacist through a contract from letting our pharmacists know what is the lowest possible cost for their medication. Pharmacists in Minnesota and across the country have been prohibited by their contracts with PBMs from letting their patient know that the cash price or that the price that the PBM is paying the pharmacy may be the lowest cost of a patient's medication for that particular medication in that particular day. Across community pharmacy, my colleagues are increasingly prohibited from providing the best counseling information and certainly lowest information on the lowest cost options for our patients because of the provisions of pharmacy benefit managers and what they include in their contracts. And one may ask, well, it's in the contract, but do these things really get enforced? I have spoken with a pharmacist who received a letter from one of the pharmacy benefit managers that he had a contract with, and the letter said, in essence, we notice a pattern from your pharmacy of transmitting a claim, which was sent back as a paid claim, and then seeing that claim reversed with no additional transaction or information on that particular medication for that patient. We can only assume from this pattern that you are sending through a claim, seeing what the copay is that you are supposed to provide, charge the patient, and pharmacies are contractually required to charge the patient that copay. We can only conclude that you are seeing what the copay price is, realizing that the patient can pay less by cash and therefore reversing the claim and selling the prescription to our enrollees at cash price. And the individual was informed that if they did not cease with that practice, they would be kicked out of the network. I think that's the most graphic illustration of the problem that we're trying to solve here with this language. It is not unusual for a patient to have a claim price or a usual copay of, let's say, $30. The pharmacy's usual cash price for that prescription, let's say, is $25. We all recognize that rarely does a healthcare payer pay a healthcare provider's usual and customary price. So, for example, let's say that the pharmacy benefit manager is going to pay the pharmacy $20 for that prescription. The claim comes back to the pharmacy saying charge the patient a $30 copay. And again, by contract, the pharmacist is required to charge the patient $30. They can, again, be kicked out of the contract if they don't do that. So the pharmacist charges the pay, either in this situation, maybe hopefully notices it, maybe decides that they're going to ignore the gag clause and tell the patient about it. If they don't, then they collect $30 from the patient. When the next remittance advice comes from that PBM, the pharmacist collected $30 from the patient. The PBM says the pharmacist is only due $20. So, pharmacist, please send me the extra $10. So often there is a situation where the patient is actually paying more for a healthcare service then their plan paid for the service. This language simply prohibits the pharmacy benefit manager from prohibiting the pharmacist from telling the patient about that situation.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Lindu.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? Members, who have any questions?
Chair Liebling. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bonner, thank you for bringing this bill. Mr. Lindu, thank you for, I'm over here. I know it's kind of, can't tell where the sound is coming from in these rooms. Representative Bonner, was this, I think this was a bill that was in the omnibus bill last session that got vetoed. I just want to confirm that with you, and if you know. And if you do, is it exactly the same language? Is there a little subtle difference, or, you know, what would be the difference?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. In fact, this bill did actually go through last time. It actually had two Republican authors on its last journey through. It did follow through all the way to the end with, I believe, rather bipartisan support and became part of that omnibus bill. But unfortunately, as we know, that did not get signed into law. I actually had a passion for this particular issue, and so I chose to take it up again this session because I think it's egregious and flat out wrong, this practice, and I'd like to see it changed.
You represent Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edison.
I just wanted to thank you for bringing up this bill. One of the things that I heard most about in my community is the cost of prescription drugs, and many of times by seniors. And so thank you for testifying on this. I just wanted to make sure. So if the pharmacist is not aware of a drug that's lesser at a lesser cost, there's no liability, correct, for not telling the consumer because they would not know?
Representative Bonner?
I can double-check the exact implications, but there is no language at this point in the bill that would indicate that. No.
Okay. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill. Looking at the front of the table there, did you bring anything there for committee members that you may have forgotten to mention?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg. And thank you for the opportunity to give a shout-out to my hometown. I am the representative for Maple Grove and Osseo. As some of you may know, of a little show on the Food Network called Cupcake Wars. And it just so happens that the proprietress of Nadia's Cakes is, in fact, the winner of one of the Cupcake Wars. So I have brought a sampling here before the committee today for everyone to try.
Well, thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, I'm looking at the front of your bill, and I want to direct your attention to a couple of lines on here. First is line 1.12, and I'm curious as to why you included the word net.
Representative Bonner.
I'm not sure. Am I looking in the right place here? 1.12. Oh. Let's see.
Or that's a better question for Mr. Lindu.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. This is the language that actually passed through on the last time around, and this refers to the amount that the pharmacy actually takes in as a matter of that claim, as opposed to the usual or customary price. I'm not sure when you ask that question if there's some other implication behind that, or I think the word is somewhat self-explanatory, so I'm not sure. Is there something else you're directing on that?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, from an accounting standpoint, when you take a look at gross receipts, that's at the top line, but the bottom line is the net.
Correct.
So my curiosity is, why did you include the net, not the gross? Because the gross would infer more of an inclusivity for all receipts, all revenue share from the various providers as opposed to net. So are you describing here after expenses, or what is inferred by the word net in this context?
Yes,
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, yes, net would include after expenses.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, again, I refer to line 1.14 now. And once the claim has been completed, so that's after the transaction has been done, the patient with their prescription has left the pharmacy and gone home, isn't it more relevant to provide that evidence of the cost at the time of the dispensing of the drug as opposed to when they receive their EOB at home?
Representative Bonner.
Okay. Let me just re-review this piece for you. I'll have to be honest with you. I am not as familiar with the accounting side of this, but I'd certainly be happy to collect that data for you and get back to you.
I think Representative Pinto may have a response to that.
Well, I'm just wondering, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I guess as I'm looking at this, I'm not sure that the language of once the claim has been completed is for the timing of when the information is provided, but rather it's simply saying that this is the amount the pharmacy will receive once the claim has been completed. I may be misreading that, but that's how I'm reading this. And I guess the other thing too is I think this is the language, as I understand it, that was as this was passed out of this body last session as well. But I think in answer to your question, it's that timing as I read it.
And Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, and I believe that Representative Lunan was the one that authored the bill last session, and I had the similar concerns that did not go answered. Back then, so I am renewing my quest to find out the information to those two specific questions. So, Representative Bonner, if you could find those answers out and respond to the committee with those, I'd appreciate it.
Thank Absolutely.
You. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, I'm wondering, you know, if the patient chooses to pay the lower cost, that the non-prescription cost, does that payment still count toward a deductible?
It would not.
Representative Bonner.
Madam Chair, Representative New, it would not.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bonner. I don't remember where the bill is going next, but I would hope that you'd consider maybe an amendment to the bill to make sure that as the patient is spending money, that would apply toward their deductible. I think that's really critical. As we know, insurance deductibles have also increased in the last several years, and we want to make sure that money is being put towards those deductibles so that their overall cost of care is still manageable.
So Representative New, once this bill moves on to Commerce, that they can sort through that. But thank you.
That's what I would ask.
Yep, thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Pass.
All right. So Representative Pearson.
I actually, in the last iteration of the bill, I'm assuming the A1 amendment wasn't on the... So I'm just asking what the implication was. It was what you wanted to put the bill in your form, and just wondering what that impact is. It seems just strike, or given the options, so its implication is that it. I guess if you could explain that, I'd just like clarity on it.
Yep. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nielsen. Yes, it was just clarifying the either or. I believe it was either or an and language. It was more or less a grammatical piece to make sure that the bill flowed properly.
All right.
Okay. There being no further discussion, Representative Bonner renews her motion that House File 149, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motions prevail.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. All opposed? Okay, thank you. The motion prevail. House File 149, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. Congratulations, Ms. Representative Bonner. All right, so we have our next bill up, House File 182, Representative Limpert. So the chair moves that House File 182 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Leeper.
Thank you.
Leppert, just bear with me, right, on these names. I believe you have an author's amendment. The chair will entertain a motion to adopt the A3 author's amendment. Representative Fisher, would like to move the A3?
I'd like to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. Got a little gavel. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Leeper, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be introducing this bill to form a drug repository in the state of Minnesota, and the content of the author's amendment will be covered through the course of testimony this afternoon as well. So this summer I read an op-ed in the Star Tribune titled, A Simple Fix to Stop Wasting Needed Drugs. And it was written by University of Minnesota graduate and student Lily Rowan Mahone, who's sitting next to me. Ms. Mahone's in the Doctorate of Pharmacy program and the Master of Public Health programs at the University of Minnesota, is also a member of the Public Health Advocacy Student Alliance. In her article, she described a problem that's familiar to us, which is the obstacle that many Minnesotans face in accessing affordable pharmaceuticals, and the obstacle at high cost is in affording pharmaceuticals. But she also described a problem that I was unfamiliar with at the time, which is that in long-term care settings, there are many drugs that go wasted. If someone dies or their medications are changed due to federal packaging regulations, those medications often need to be thrown away. Even if they're in single usage doses or in monthly blister packs, which look like this, even if it's untampered, unused, they often need to go in the trash. As a pastor, I spend quite a bit of time in long-term care facilities visiting members of my congregation, but was unfamiliar with this reality in relation to medications. So I asked my wife, who's a hospice social worker, if she knew anything about this, and she said, yes, there's a lot of medication in long-term care settings that goes to waste. So I was definitely intrigued and wanted an opportunity to work on this if I made it to the legislature. Now, in the article, Ms. Mahone also described a way to address both of these problems, which is the establishment of a statewide drug repository program. It's not an idea that's new or particularly unusual. There are 21 states that have a program like this that forms a central repository, a place where unused, unopened, untampered medications can be sent. And that's also a location where individuals who lack insurance or underinsured or lack prescription drug coverage can access needed medications. The state of Iowa and the state of Wyoming have particularly successful programs that have been in operation for over 10 years. In the state of Wyoming, $12.5 million has been repurposed by the reuse of medications. In Iowa, $17.7 million has been repurposed for medication usage through this program. This legislation to start a drug repository in Minnesota was introduced last session, and it had bipartisan support. It was included in the supplemental budget omnibus bill, and it was fully vetoed by Governor Dayton. It's being reintroduced this session. It has bipartisan support again. I'm glad to be carrying the bill. I look forward to the difference it will make for Minnesotans who need access to pharmaceuticals. I look forward to closing this particular waste stream within our healthcare system in our state. And I'm glad to turn the testimony now over to Ms. Rowan Mahone.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and who you represent and begin your testimony.
Hi, I'm Rowan Mann, and I am representing the Public Health Advocacy Student Alliance, which is a student group at the University of Minnesota. I want to thank you for allowing me to have this time to talk with you, and I was hoping I could talk to you about medication waste. In long-term care facilities, when a patient changes medications or if they don't need their medications anymore, they are in those bubble packs or other form packaging, and a lot of times those medications, if they aren't needed anymore, have to be thrown away. And I understand that probably doesn't seem like how much waste could that really be, but in 2014 there was a study ran, and it showed that the U.S. was wasting $2 billion worth of safe, usable medications. That's a great study, but the study that I really like is from Colorado. They did a state-specific study looking at their 220 long-term care facilities, and they estimated that they are wasting $10 million a year worth of safe medications. For reference, Minnesota has 365 long-term care facilities. The president, actually, of Care Providers, which is an organization that helps, that runs long-term care facilities, the president of Care Providers estimated that Minnesota could be wasting upwards to $16 million a year of throwing away safe medications. At the same time, we all know that patients are struggling to afford medications. I used to work at a local hospital, and I would work in their ER, and I would help patients make sure that their medications list were okay. And every shift I worked, I was there with somebody who was having an asthma attack whose hypertension wasn't under control, and they were in the ER receiving care, and they were there because they hadn't taken their medications, generally because they couldn't afford their medications. So this legislation would allow that medication waste to go to patients in need. It's based off of Iowa's legislation. 21 other states have medication repositories. I specifically like Iowa and Wyoming. They are two of the largest repositories across the U.S. Iowa's been running since 2007. They have been able to work with 71,000 patients, and we distribute over $17.7 million. Those are actually the numbers from 2017. They haven't released 2018 yet, so those numbers will have increased since then. And I think it will be a really great asset to Minnesota if we are able to implement a program here. And Cody Weiberg of the Board of Pharmacy actually helped write the legislation, and he is here today to testify as well.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Mr. Weiberg, please identify yourself and present your presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. First thing I want to say is, Ms. Mann mentioned that I helped draft this bill, but Ms. Mann and her other students that she worked with have impressed me mightily, and really the credit belongs to them, really fully, for bringing this issue forward and for getting it actually through the legislature in one session. I've actually told her that was really good, because sometimes it takes me 5 years to get things through the legislature. So, but I did help draft the legislation, put it in a form that was acceptable to the Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy last year and this year considered the bill. The board fully supports the bill, particularly with the author's amendment. And the representative has asked me to explain a little bit about the author's amendment. Most of it's just technical. So, for example, when we were going through the bill again this year, we decided to add something a little bit more specific about storage conditions. So we actually mentioned temperature and humidity. I noticed that when I drafted the bill, when it came to what are called the local repositories, I put in language that said they had to follow all the federal and state, applicable federal and state rules. I hadn't put that in for the central repository, so we added that in this year. The issue about who's eligible for the program, that did not come from the board. I believe that came from the Department of Human Services. I'm looking at it. I think it might simply be some clarification language for them, because the existing line in question basically says that for a person to come to the repositories and receive medications, they have to be uninsured. I took that to also mean not being on medical assistance or Minnesota health care programs, but for reasons I can't really answer, I think DHS wanted this language to really clarify that and solidify that. The other big change from last year to this year, and this did take some discussion at the board meeting, but the board members unanimously supported this bill, is the last year's version did not allow donations from individuals for drugs from their household. But the board has decided, after studying what has been done in other states, that if those donations are properly handled and vetted by the pharmacist working in the repository, they can, in fact, potentially be reused. And I think some of the research that Ms. Mann has done has showed that many of those that ultimately are accepted from households, although many are rejected by the repositories in Iowa, many of them that can be accepted are very high-cost cancer therapy drugs. And so the board has agreed to go ahead and expand this concept to allowing donations from individuals, not just long-term care facilities. There is an appropriation article added, and I would just say to that, you know, this isn't the Finance Committee, but the cost last year that I attributed to this was $14,000, and I don't think it's going to be much more than that. That comes out of our appropriation at the Board of Pharmacy, not out of the general fund. The last thing I guess I would talk about is the very last thing that is on the author's amendment. It's the drug return for credit. Just wanted to make sure. The reality is, and I used to be the state's pharmacy program manager for DHS and ran the Medicaid program. I'm not sure what the law is in Iowa, but the law in Minnesota actually does allow long-term care facilities, at least certain types of long-term care facilities like skilled nursing facilities and Class F assisted living facilities, to return drugs to the pharmacy. The pharmacy is then, if they're usable, is supposed to credit the payer. And so I'm not sure what the revenue is these days, but when I was with DHS, with Medicaid, we expected that to occur. And so the department got money back from these credits. So this just makes sure that there's not some incentive created to not do that, to not credit the drugs back when they can be appropriately credited. All
right. So thank you for your testimony. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg, for the explanation of the author's amendment. There's one section you didn't cover. I was just wondering about this, the repealer on lines 2.1 and 2.2. Okay. I looked up the statute being repealed, and it's a cancer drug repository program. My assumption would be that that's no longer that, assuming we adopt this, that will no longer be needed because everything that was included within the cancer drug repository program will be included within this larger drug repository program. Is that a safe assumption?
Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, basically, there's another reason. The cancer drug repository was very well intentioned, but it has never functioned. I really think it's because of the way that was structured. We had two hospitals initially sign up to be cancer drug repositories, but they quickly realized there was literally only one or two medications that they could actually take back, and it wasn't worth the effort. When Ms. Mann came to me, I originally thought about just rewriting 151.55, but it was simply easier to repeal it and write a new section.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiberg, thank you for your testimony. And my question is on the amendment, again, on lines 1.3 and 1.4. I'm wondering if the requirement of being uninsured and not enrolled in medical assistance is overly restrictive. And what I mean by that is, first of all, do we have a number of how many people are uninsured in Minnesota,
Dr. Weiberg,
at this point?
Madam Chair, Representative New, I could maybe try to find out, try to find that out for you. My information, that's a little bit dated. I know, you know, 14 years ago when I was working at DHS, about 85% of Minnesotans had some sort of drug coverage. My guess is it's well above 90% now because of the advent of Medicare Part D in 2006. But there are still a significant number of people that do not have insurance. The exact number I can't give you. Why this additional language was added, I really don't know. I think DHS wanted this language, and I could work with them to get an answer to you. As I mentioned in my testimony, I had intended to, when I drafted this, to have uninsured mean any sort of insurance, including publicly funded insurance, but they, for some reason, do want this additional language.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lippert, perhaps this would be for you. You know, as someone who cared for someone who was chronically ill, and I mean, we were paying over $1,000 a month for prescription medications, I think I love this concept. I think it's really, really good. I would just suggest that perhaps moving forward, as the bill moves through the process, you might want to consider an amendment with an income threshold as opposed to being uninsured. And I say that just because, you know, there are people who may be relatively low income insured but are still paying significant copays. We were certainly fully insured, and I was paying over $1,000 a month for medications. And while we could squeak by with that, I suspect that that would be a significant hardship to many families, even with insurance. So I would maybe consider doing an income threshold on that, yeah, as opposed to an insurance threshold.
That point is well taken, and we'll look into what other states are doing in relation to that income threshold as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lawler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cody, I was wondering, I remember us passing a law some time ago that allowed nursing homes, that I assume it was just probably the larger ones that did this, that were allowed to do machine dispensing of the most commonly used drugs. And obviously there's thousands of prescriptions, and this will work with all of them. But the goal of that was actually to minimize the waste when someone passes away or their prescription changes or whatever, and so that the resident of the nursing facility would only be charged for what actually was dispensed to them. And has that been taken up in your experience, or maybe in the other witnesses' experience, much by the nursing home industry? Because that seemed like, if for the most common drugs we could get that practice into place, it would divert less from, you know, this, but it'd be a much more efficient sort of system. Mm-hmm. But I wondered if it had just ever taken off.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Weibert.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, indeed it has. I can actually get you the exact numbers because one of my staff people tracks all the applications to place those machines. I can tell you right now there are dozens, not hundreds, but there are at least dozens of them around Minnesota. But those machines work best in very large skilled nursing facilities. So there are many smaller skilled nursing facilities, and I think there may be only one or two Class F assisted living facilities that have machines of that type. So there are still many, many long-term care facilities that would be able to donate drugs if this legislation passes.
Thank you very much. I had expected that as well. I just didn't know if it ever went.
Yep.
Sometimes you have good ideas, and then they just don't work out well.
It did.
All right. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Weinberg?
Weinberg.
Could you just briefly walk us through what this looks like in real life? So I'm a patient. I go to your pharmacy. You're a repository pharmacy. Mm-hmm. I don't have insurance. I fill out paperwork. And then I have a prescription for something, and you may or may not have it in your stock. And then you are then able to give that to me. That's it.
Dr. Weiber.
Madam Chair, can't see your nameplate. Representative Mann, first it's Weiberg, rhymes with Freiberg, as you pointed out to me the other day. So the way that this would work is the board did not want to run the repository program itself. So the way that this legislation was crafted is the board will put out an RFP to choose a central repository. I obviously wouldn't know that now, but I would imagine that might be a large hospital-based pharmacy or health system pharmacy, maybe in the Twin Cities. They, in turn, then are allowed to choose local repositories, and our hope is that that will be around the state. And the donations are going to come in to either a local or central repository. They're going to have to be checked and vetted by a pharmacist to make sure they're acceptable for donation. And then they will be distributed between the repositories where the need is. If you qualify for the program, you still need a prescription because these are going to be prescription drugs. And this is also why the repositories are going to be need to be licensed as a pharmacy. If in fact a pharmacist is doing the dispensing, so that the pharmacist is going to take your prescription just like you would in a regular pharmacy, follow all the same statutes and rules for dispensing the prescription, label it appropriately, and dispense it to the patient. They're allowed to charge a fairly minimal fee that's tied in with the Medicaid dispensing fee, I believe, to recover some of their costs. And that's basically how the system would, in fact, work. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in this legislation that would prohibit a pharmacy from doing what a lot of pharmacies already do. So these pharmacies can, if there aren't any, with the winter weather like we've had now, if there aren't any shipping concerns, people who actually can't make it into the repository could still potentially have prescriptions mailed to their home. Once the drugs are donated, the operation is going to be very similar to the dispensing part of the operation is going to be very similar to what would happen in a retail pharmacy. The other thing that's possible here, and I don't know what the relative uptake could be, it's possible that maybe a federally qualified healthcare clinic would be a local repository, and instead of a pharmacist dispensing, it would be a practitioner dispensing, like a physician or a nurse practitioner. But actually, the Board of Pharmacy regulates all dispensing, no matter who does it. And the last five parts in our chapter of rules are about practitioner dispensing, and the practitioners would just need to follow those parts.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mann.
Thank you.
All right. So is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 182? Is there any further discussion from members? Questions? Okay. There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 182, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. House File 182, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committees on Ways and Means. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So we have our last bill on the calendar, House File 4, Representative Lesh. So the chair has moved. House File 4 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I believe you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have the DE 2 amendment. It's DE something.
DE 1-2.
DE 1-2. Well, I was half right.
Okay. So the chair will entertain a motion to adopt the DE 1-2 author's amendment.
So moved.
So moved, Representative Pinto. Representative Pinto moves the DE 1-2 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Les, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully the final vote goes that way, too. Members, in September 2015, Martin Shkreli raised the price of a popular anti-parasitic AIDS medication 5,000%, earning him widespread criticism and the moniker Pharma Bro. Now, despite contentions by the industry that this was a one-off, we do see this practice continuing. And I would quote here Matthew Harper from a February 2017 article in Forbes. Before him, we had the case of McKenna, used to prevent preterm birth. It was launched in 2011 at a price of $1,500 when a similar drug was previously available from compounding pharmacies for $20. The strategy basically worked. AMAG Pharmaceuticals, which now owns McKenna, booked sales of $93 million in the third quarter of last year. So the question is, why does this keep happening? With the exception of Martin Shkreli, enabled by a thicket of market efficiencies, the reason is because it's the law. And that's very much the case for the Marathon and Emflaza, which was a 6,000% increase thereafter. So clearly the public shame of Martin Shkreli raising the price of a popular anti-parasitic drug used to treat AIDS patients 5,000%, that shame was not enough to get folks to stop doing this. So this this bill, House File 4, the Delete All Amendment, intends to change the law and to end these outrageous practices for Minnesotans who depend on these drugs for their health and even for their very lives. So it's pretty simple. The Delete All Amendment starts with the words of the Attorney General, who is here and will be testifying on this, and authorizes him to enforce this law under Minnesota Statutes 8.31. Section 2 authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to impose civil sanctions. Section 3 authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to take disciplinary action against those who use such practices. And Section 4 is the meat of the bill. It defines an essential prescription drug. It defines unconscionable. It directs notification to the Attorney General if the price rises above a certain amount. It directs the Human Services Commissioner to keep a list of these drugs designated as essential, and it also grants a private right of action. Madam Chair and members, sick people are not going without their medicine because there's not enough medicine. Sick people are going without their medicine because we cannot satisfy some people's greed. So it's my hope that the cautionary tale told by Mr. Harper and Forbes a couple years ago is heeded, and that's that these great drugs, some of which are, you know, I would note that many of us in here have stories about some of these remarkable drugs that save lives. Just this last weekend, my mom had a major stroke, but you wouldn't know it. Because they gave her something within 4 hours of the stroke that took away the clots, and she's walking up and down the hallways now, something that I think maybe 20 years ago, I probably wouldn't be here right now. I'd probably be planning for a funeral. So I think we understand how important these things are. But as Mr. Harper observes, you won't get credit for these wonderful innovations your companies produce if your prices make people feel sick. And that's the consequence that we're facing here. So with that, I'm assuming that all these people charging billable hours are here for this bill, Madam Chair. So I'll end it with that and allow people to be heard on both sides of this.
Well, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and glad to know that your mother is doing well.
Thank you.
Come to the first testifier, Attorney General Keith Ellison from the state of Minnesota. Could you... Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Please identify yourself for the records and tell us who you represent. And,
Madam Chair, my name is Keith Ellison, and I am the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. And I'm certainly here to urge support of the piece of legislation forwarded by Representative Lesch. But mostly I'm here because I have talked to so many people who have been faced with such dramatic cost increases that simply cannot be justified by research, expense, all types of considerations which might justify an expense. Representative Lesch just got through talking about the Shkreli case. The drug in that case was a drug called Daraprim. Daraprim is used for other illnesses other than AIDS. It actually is used for people who have a disease called toxoplasmosis. And I know about that. I know more about it than I want to know about it, because a very brilliant staff member of mine, and she does not mind her name being used, her name was Abby Shanfield, had that disease and came close to death's door on more occasions than she or her mother would ever like to contemplate. And that disease, and that drug, she used to get for about $13 a dose until it went up to about $800 a dose. And so Martin Scorelli did not invent the drug. He didn't do the research for the drug. All he did is buy a patent and then maximized his advantage because he owned a monopoly on that drug. But why stop there? We could talk about EpiPen. We could move on to insulin. We could talk about a number of drugs where families simply have been put in untenable financial situations because they cannot afford the drugs that keep them alive every single day. And so that's why I'm here, to support House File 4, which prohibits a manufacturer or wholesale pharmaceutical drug distributor from price gouging consumers. Over the past decade, we've seen a dramatic rise in prescription drug prices, and we've just talked a little bit about some of them. My office here is from Minnesotans all over the state of Minnesota. We gather in complaints, and we hear that people are receiving bills that they just can't afford and cannot sustain their lives. This is just from the Minnesotans who call the AG's office. There's many more folks who talk to just their family or just their doctor or just suffer in silence. This legislation offers a cause of action which we believe as an essential tool to protect Minnesotans from price gouging. Under the bill, the Board of Pharmacy and the Commissioner of Human Services and health plan companies must notify the Attorney General's office of any increase in 1 year period of 15% or more on a essential drug. That notification is important because it allows us to step forward and take action if it is warranted. House File 4 also directs my office to investigate violations of the prohibition against charging unconscionable prices, and in order for the Attorney General's office to bring an action against the drug company for charging an unconscionable price, the manufacturer is given the opportunity to first meet with our office to talk about whether or not this exorbitant price can be justified by some legitimate market consideration, some shortage of something that happened in the market that might explain why their drug went up 15% in a year. And so this has necessary guardrails and less necessary restraints. And House File 4 will also provide, most importantly, the people of Minnesota with some transparency in costs associated with getting the medicine they need. And so this bill, which will allow me to investigate and enforce the prohibition against charging unconscionable prices for prescription drugs, I think is a necessary tool to meet the realities of the moment that we're living in. And I think that it would be great if you pass this bill, we never have to use it, because parties will simply know unconscionable price gouging is simply not what we do in Minnesota. So with that, I would yield back, ma'am, and thank the committee for listening.
Thank you. We have several testifiers on the list, but I'm thinking that maybe the Attorney General may have a busy schedule, so I'm going to open it up for anyone who may have any questions now. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Ellison, good afternoon.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon to you.
I notice in the context of the bill that Representative Lesch has put forward that you're exempting yourself from rulemaking authority. Can I understand why?
Attorney General Ellison?
Madam Chair, I think you'd have to ask the author of the bill about that particular provision. I'll say that the provisions that are there are ones that our office has reviewed and agree with.
Representative Lesch, would you?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. The Attorney General is not an agency of the executive branch. It's an independently elected office. So I did not think it was necessary to include that in there. Now, there are other folks maybe who can speak to that more, but that's my answer for you right now.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellison, you're familiar with the Maryland case, I'm sure.
Madam Chair, yes, I am.
Madam Chair, and the Circuit Court struck down that law based upon the Commerce Clause.
Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, yes, I'm aware that in the 4th District that case is currently pending. I don't believe that litigation is concluded at this point. But this bill is actually different from the Maryland case. We've actually looked at it, and I believe we've corrected for the problems that it may have. So I think that the challenges that piece of legislation had are different from this one, and that's one of the reasons we think it's a solid piece of legislation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Lesch or Mr. Ellison, could you articulate those changes?
Representative Lesch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I mean, the bill is entirely rewritten, so to articulate through the entire thing, it might be more appropriate for staff to do it, but I can't tell you line by line. I would note that, as stated by Attorney General Ellison, this is a different bill. I would also note that I would encourage you to read the dissent in the 4th District case. First of all, Minnesota is not the 4th District, so we are not bound by that decision. It's a different state. I'm sure that it would be used as persuasive by pharmaceutical companies or trade groups to argue that this would be similar. However, in the dissent, it was a 2-1 decision, and the judge that voted against the upholding of the district court decision in that case described the court's position on this as an outlier, that other districts have not pursued this broad of a reading of the Dormant Commerce Clause as they did in this Maryland case. So I feel very confident that there's no reason why other circuits would follow suit on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellison, I did read the opinion. And what's interesting in there is that under the conclusion, it says the practical effect of the statute by also considering how the challenge statute may interact with the legitimate regulatory regimes of other states, that effect would arise if one, but many or others, in a sense, you're interfering with interstate commerce under the dormant clause. So in a sense, if you're selling drugs of any price into the state of Minnesota, but you're from another state, and they're conflicting with another state, by virtue of adhering to the state of Minnesota's drug regime pricing, you might be in conflict with another state. How do you reconcile that?
Well,
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I would note that this is HHS policy, and I'm sure this is going to be going to judiciary, so maybe we could bring that up there. That said, from what I recall of the Commerce Clause and Dormant Commerce Clause going back to law school 20 years ago, 25 years ago now, there has been extremely broad application of the Commerce Clause in the past, all the way to this Ohio farmer in the 30s that was ordered to pay a penalty on growing wheat for his own cattle on his own farm, which I'm sure you conservatives would have hated that application of it, but they have reeled back on it since that time. And if you want to reapply a broad effect of the federal government on the states to govern themselves, there are all kinds of negative consequences that I'm sure would not be upheld in the GOP party platform. But to the extent you say, hold on a second, this will impact Wisconsin or Iowa or South Dakota, I say that the state of Minnesota has a right to protect its citizens from unconscionable drug price increases. And that's what our Attorney General is here to do. And I think that's what we're going to do. And at the end of the day, if this gets litigated, then let them litigate it. But it's our job here in this committee to protect the public.
Representative Albright.
Just one more question then.
Let's, remember the scope of the policy committee, that this bill is going to be traveling through to other committees in the areas that you are focusing on.
Representative Lesch, on page 7 of the bill, line 1-4, you talk about a drug costing more than $80. Why did you set into the legislation that dollar amount? Who was consulted, and how was that determination made?
Well, Representative Lynn.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, when I first dropped this bill a year ago, I knew you guys weren't going to give it a hearing, and so I didn't put not a lot had happened to it since then, since we decided it was going to be one of our top 10 priorities this year. So I don't have specific recollection as to how we arrived at the $80. I do know that a conversation was had about setting some static limit, because if you don't set any static limit, that drugs that are very, very low in price may get that designation as unconscionable that we wouldn't necessarily think. The average person wouldn't think is unconscionable. So it was an effort to limit an overbroad application of the bill if the price of a drug was $5 and it went to $10. It's not intended to capture situations like that. So we set a limit of $80, which roughly corresponds to what we think a person who needs these drugs could reasonably afford for a 30-day supply.
All right, members. Representative Newt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, I keep hearing you guys talk about an increase, the 15% increase. Does this exclusively apply to when the cost of a medication increases by that amount?
Representative Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative New, that is when I believe the Attorney General received notification, if I'm recollecting correctly. Yeah, notification of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy shall notify the Attorney General of any increase of 15% or more during a one-year period.
Representative New.
So does this then apply exclusively to that, or is that the only time that the Attorney General automatically receives notification?
That's, Madam Chair and Representative New, that's when he receives notification.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. So this will apply to new medications as well that have not necessarily seen an increase but are new medications, so there's no 15% comparison.
Madam Chair and Representative New, no, this is a price change. If there wasn't a price before and there was a price, I mean, now that's not like it goes from zero to $1,000 or something. I don't even know what percentage that is, if it exists.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, do we have any further questions
Madam Chair, could the Attorney General respond to that?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Ellison.
So, Subdivision 3 prohibits a drug manufacturer, wholesale drug distributor, from charging unconscionable prices. So the thing is, if you have a drug that is relatively new and it's been on the market for a while, and then there's a precipitous increase, which fits the definition of unconscionability, then the Attorney General's office could take action. But if you have a drug for which there's never been a price, and now all of a sudden you put it out on the market, you have nothing to compare it to. So that's the way it would work.
So we have two more on the list, Representative Backer and Pearson. Is your question directed to the Attorney General?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. Explain, I think the public would like to know, let's say this bill becomes law and it goes through the litigation. What do you see as the process of your office going through the process to that a price is too high? How do you foresee going through it? I'm assuming your staff has kind of thought this through, and just what you're thinking. I think the public would want to know. I would like to know what your thoughts are there, Mr. Ellison.
Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, well, if I could refer you to the definition of unconscionability in the statute, I think what we're I could refer you to. Page 7, unconscionable price means the price that is not reasonably justified by actual costs of inventing, producing, selling, and distributing the prescription drug, and any actual costs of the appropriate expansion of access to the drug to promote public health, and applies to a prescription drug for which Minnesota consumers for whom the drug has been or will be prescribed, the Minnesota Commission of Human Services, the health plan companies providing medical care to the Minnesota consumers, have no meaningful choice about whether to purchase because there is no other comparable drug sold in Minnesota at a price that is reasonably justified by the actual cost of inventing, producing, selling, and distributing the prescription drug and any actual cost of appropriate expansion. So when we find that we have seen a drug that has been priced in such a way, the statute would require us to engage the drug manufacturer. So we'll engage in a process where we will talk with them, as we often do, in about whether or not there is some justification for an exorbitant price. And if there's not one, and if we believe that the statute has been met, we could take enforcement action. So what we would do is, engage in discovery and see if we can bring forth a case that meets the statute. And if so, we would enforce the law and to protect consumers.
And I appreciate that. Thank you, Attorney General. So I hear a lot in your statement, who would be left to determine what prices are reasonable, justified by cost?
Well,
Madam Chair, at the end of the day, Representative, it could well be a jury that decides this, or a judge who was a fact finder, actually. And so, but we will make a determination based on metrics that we come up with that this price of this drug is simply exorbitant. You can rest assured that there are so many drugs that have such exorbitant prices that I think most reasonable people would agree that some of these price increases have just been explosive. Take, for example, EpiPen. And we would take, for example, insulin, which has gone up 1,200% in the last 20 years, or the example of Daraprim, which has already been cited. I mean, the problem in this situation is not that there are some drugs that had some reasonable cost changes based on justifiable market conditions. The problem is people just can't afford the drugs that they need on to survive. And we will use that as our guidepost.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Pearson, you have a question? Okay. All right. So no further questions. We're going to bring up the next testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Will Phillips. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. My name is Will Phillips. I'm the state director for AARP Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. With more than 670,000 members here in Minnesota, AARP appreciates the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4, which allows, as we've heard, the Attorney General to sue drug manufacturers for unconscionable price increases. We want to thank Representative Lesch for bringing this legislation forward. Prescription drug prices are a high priority for AARP. Our members are 50 years of age and older, and many of them, just like everybody else, struggle every day to afford needed and life-saving medications. We know high drug costs hurt everyone, not only those who rely on prescription drugs for their health and chronic conditions, but really all of us who are paying higher premiums, higher out-of-pocket costs, and as well as taxpayers who help fund lots of critical public programs. Americans have seen their prescription drug prices skyrocket. About 30 years ago, the public was outraged over a drug approaching $10,000 in cost. And now we're seeing drugs approaching $1 million per year. And so it's hardly surprising that our members consistently tell us that they can't afford the medications they need and are forced to make difficult choices as a result. AARP did some survey work in the last election, the 2018 midterms, and in that survey found that 92% of voters age 50 and older told us that candidates' positions on lowering drug costs were important to them, with 74% saying they were very important. Along those lines, AARP has been conducting research for many years around the cost of prescription drugs, and our research shows that drug prices are rising faster than inflation and quickly out of reach for many of our members. One particular specialty drug noted that in, or one particular study rather on specialty drugs noted in 2015 that the annual average retail cost of prescription drug therapy for a specialty drug was $52,486 per year. And to put this in perspective, this annual cost was slightly less than the median U.S. household income, $55,775, more than twice the median income for Medicare beneficiaries, $25,150, and more than three times higher than the average Social Security retirement benefit, which is around $16,000. These cost trends are simply unsustainable, and more must be done to keep these drug costs under control. And moreover, for our members in particular, older Minnesotans tend to take more drugs on average, typically 2 to 4 prescription drugs to manage chronic conditions, so any increase can make the cost of these drugs simply unaffordable. A couple of things that we've heard from our members that I wanted to raise up. One example is the story of Claire Henn, who lives right here in St. Paul. Claire should be taking a prescription Remicade for her rheumatoid arthritis, but the prescription that once cost her $60 for a treatment now costs $1,400. And due to these outrageous costs, she no longer can afford it and is going without. And she's now getting to the point where she's finding it difficult to grasp a knife or a fork. The reality for Claire is that to afford this drug would force her out of her home. And so she is forced into a harsh trade-off that is all too common, which is sacrificing her health and quality of life so that she can keep her home. She's angry, and she should be. Another story that we heard, a couple AARP members in La Crescent, Sue and Tom Counters. Sue has breast cancer and has a prescription costing more than $240,000 a year. They feel lucky because they have insurance, but even with insurance, their out-of-pocket is around $12,000 annually. They worry if they just had their Social Security, like so many other Minnesotans, or their pension alone, it would be impossible to even afford that $12,000. We're hearing these stories every day, and we're hearing about the dire, serious health and financial consequences that are associated with them. So on behalf of them and countless others, it's time for Minnesota to take action to rein in these costs this year. We strongly believe that House File 4 will allow us to do that, providing tools for transparency and action in this effort. Efforts such as this bill and others introduced this session could save tens of billions of dollars for patients, for taxpayers, and for our healthcare system. And more importantly, they can ensure that all Minnesotans have affordable access to the drugs they need to get and stay healthy. Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you.
And thank you for your testimony.
Certainly.
Our next testifier will be Jessica Neiman. So I'm sorry, Mr. Phillips, I think we have a question for you. Representative Albright.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Phillips, in the latter example that you just gave about the woman whose drug cost was $240,000 per year for a medication that's saving her life, and we don't want to disparage that at all, but from a contextual perspective, do you know how much money it cost to create that drug?
I do not.
So in the Madam Chair and Mr. Phillips, in the context of the cost to the patient, isn't it also important to appreciate how much time and money it costs for a pharmaceutical company? I'm not trying to, you know, carry their water per se, but I'm trying to give a context of the number of years and the amount of research and cost and risk that went into bringing that drug to market through the various FDA trials and whatnot and screens. So are you suggesting that $240,000 for a life-saving drug is not worth the amount of money that company undertook the risk for to bring it to market?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
Phillips.
Not at all. I think, as others have articulated here today during this meeting and the previous, these drugs are miracles that are saving people's lives. We don't discount that one bit. I think the beauty of this legislation is that we don't know until we ask the question. And as it is, this price gouging is going on without that sunshine being cast on what the process is. Why was there a 15, 20, 30, 40% price increase? And so to our understanding, and the reason why we support this legislation is that if that price increase happens, let's open it up. Let's find out what drove that cost increase. If it's justifiable, then we should know that. If it's not, we should know that too and make sure that we're doing things to protect people's access to these drugs.
Madam Chair, Mr. Phillips, so then you're suggesting that any company that is involved in the medical community or pharmacological community is subject to scrutiny of their financial books, their accounts, the manner in which that they go about preparing pro formas, all of that would be under the jurisdiction unilaterally of the Attorney General?
Representative Albright, I'm not prepared to speak to that. I think we're speaking to this particular legislation. I would defer to Representative Lesch on the particulars.
And Madam Chair, I think it's, you know, in context, Mr. Representative Lesch can certainly speak to it, but that's the inference that I get from the determination that the Attorney General has the wherewithal to decide what first unconscionable is above a base of 15%, but even more so the ambiguity, because he's not subject to rulemaking or the oversight of the legislature, he could pull any organization in the country into the state of Minnesota and demand an accounting for the way that they price their product that is sold in Minnesota. That's the way this bill reads.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative Albright, the Attorney General can already do that for any number of industries. I mean, the number of attorneys general that have signed on to the immigration debate of last year, that was a national issue, but attorneys general signed on to that. And I would also state, no, it's not the discretion of the Attorney General, it's the discretion of the judge. So if a judge wants to review certain items in camera based on some kind of trade secret claim by the pharmaceutical company, I mean, that would certainly be on the table too. If they can make a claim, no, this is going to put us at a competitive disadvantage. So I don't think that it's as broad of a power that you're suggesting.
Chair Liebling, do you have a response?
Well, I think there was someone that called me.
Representative Pinto.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So when I look at this, I mean, it seems really strictly tied to the language about the actual cost of inventing, producing, selling, distributing the drugs. I guess to Representative Albright's point, it seems to me that, you know, if the actual costs are that high, then that's going to be reflected in recognizing the price is in fact conscionable, not unconscionable. So I guess to that point about are we somehow disconnecting this from the actual cost of the drug? In fact, it's just the opposite. That as I read this, it's tying it very closely to the actual cost of the drug. And of course, if there is a point at which there's concern then that the what's being charged is in fact unconscionable, then as Representative Lesch pointed out, then there may well be litigation regarding that. But that first step is having to show that that the price appears to be unconscionable. So to my mind, this is quite tied in with the cost that may well be high in producing some of these drugs. But is that in fact justifying a cost to consumers, which is even higher? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm just wondering, did anyone have a question in regards to Mr. Phillips? Okay. So we're going to call the next testifier, and then Representative Edison.
I just wanted to cite to Mr. Albright's point here. Insulin for Alex Smith was $250 a month, and then we saw the cost of that increase to $1,300. Now, I think that we can all agree that that's not really reasonable.
Jessica? Please identify yourself for the records and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Moran, members of the committee. I'm Jessica Nyman with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We represent 22,000 bedside nurses who live and work in Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin and Iowa. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 4. At MNA, we believe that not only is healthcare a human right, but that it is the foundation for strong and thriving communities. For nurses, it's why caring extends beyond the bedside for patients. Our nurses continually see the consequences of Minnesotans unable to afford their medication. If our president, Mary Turner, were here today, she would tell you about a couple of patients that she recently cared for. It was a father and a son who were both admitted to the hospital because the father was rationing his insulin and sharing it with the son who couldn't afford it. Not only is this immoral, but the cost of a hospital stay furthers the financial burden for patients and for taxpayers. This story is just one of the many, one of many that nurses see day in and day out. Exorbitant price increases not only jeopardize the immediate health of Minnesotans, but they also further serve to create winners and losers in our healthcare system. How much money you make shouldn't determine your ability to access basic and essential care. MNA supports efforts like House File 4 to curb the increasing cost of prescription drugs on Minnesota families, and we also believe it's imperative that the Attorney General be empowered to fight for consumers and patients in Minnesota. We would urge you to support House File 4, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. So we have next Rick Varco. All right, please introduce yourself.
Chair Moran and members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I am the political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, testifying in support of House File 4 on behalf of our union. We represent over 35,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We cannot deal with the high cost of prescription drugs unless we use aggressive tools to reduce the price. This bill defines an unconscionable price and says drug companies cannot force sick people to pay an unconscionable price. I am here today because that is what drug companies did to the family of one of our members. That member is James Holt, Jr. He is a service worker at Southdale Hospital and executive board member of our union. Recently, James and his wife, Nicole, have been in the news and at the Capitol a lot. They have been telling the story of how the high cost of insulin killed their son, Alec. In fact, they can't be here today because at the State of the Union speech, Nicole Holtsmith will be the guest of Senator Amy Klobuchar. For those who have not heard the story, let me summarize quickly. Alec was diagnosed with diabetes and needed regular insulin to manage his condition. When Alec grew too old to stay on his parents' insurance plan, he struggled to find one that would cover the cost of his illness. As his mother wrote in the Star Tribune, quote, "For Alec, this meant that his insulin and supplies cost almost $1,300 a month. He and I together researched for months in advance about his health care options. They weren't good. The best plan we found would cost him $450 a month for the premium with a whopping $7,600 deductible. That deductible meant he would be paying out of pocket for his medicine for many months anyway. So he decided to go without a plan until he could find a different job with benefits," unquote. 27 days after his coverage lapsed, unable to afford insulin and rationing his supply to make it last, Alex was found dead in his apartment, killed by the very condition insulin would have prevented. I want to simply focus today on the $1,300 a month cost. In 1996, the Humalog brand of insulin from Eli Lilly cost $21 a vial, to the representative's point. This year, it was $275. Lantus from Sanofi was $35 a vial when it was introduced in 2001. This year, it was $270. Novo Nordisk Novolog was priced at $40 in 2001, and as of July 2018, it was $289. It is this excessive cost that is the root of the problem. If charging that much is not unconscionable, I don't know what would be. We cannot expect drug companies to correct their own behavior. As the great conservative economist Milton Friedman said, quote, "There is one and only one social responsibility of business, to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as they stay within the rules of the game." Most of the time, as you've heard, it works great, and we have much for which to thank them, but we cannot expect them to solve this problem. When a drug company looked at Alex, they saw a perfect customer. His need was absolute, immediate, and constant. He would pay whatever money he had as soon as he had it, so of course they would set the price high. But you have the power to change the rules of the game. You can insist that the life of a person is more important than unlimited profit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Schundemeyer? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the records.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, my name is Steven Schundemeyer. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in Pharmaceutical Management and Economics. I'm here today representing myself and not the university officially. I became aware of this bill, and I've studied the pharmaceutical market and drugs and prices for about 45 years, most of my career, and I've seen the patterns that happen in this marketplace. One of my roles at the university is to help manage our drug benefit plan for our employees, and I stay very clear of HIPAA violations. I make sure I don't look at anything inappropriate, but I track each prescription claim that comes in. And over the last couple of years, I've noticed some things that really trouble me, that our system is not capturing and pushing back on certain prices. So one example, the first one I would bring up is Zegrid. Zegrid's a drug. You might remember the purple pill, Prilosec, the drug for the bad pizza you had last night. Well, Prilosec, a company has now taken the ingredient of that, omeprazole, and combined it with sodium bicarbonate, baking soda. And that combination now actually sells as an over-the-counter drug product for $23 for 42, or you can get a 90-day supply for less than $50. But I noticed about a year and a half ago, prescriptions coming in, and we were billed by our PBM, and we paid, as a university, $17,000 for a 90-day supply of the drug that cost $23 over-the-counter if we had known about it. That's unconscionable in my mind. We went to our PBM and said, hey, why didn't you catch this? Can we stop this? And we put a stop to that particular drug. I thought, okay, this is a one-shot deal. It won't happen again. So now, a year ago, I saw prescriptions coming through for metformin. If you don't know, metformin is an oral medication for diabetic patients. It's the first line of therapy for diabetic patients orally. And one can buy a 3-month supply of metformin for about $20, even the sustained release form of metformin for about $20. There's a new product that came on the marketplace called Glumetza, which is simply metformin in a different dosage form. It releases it with a different timed release. But the clinical studies say there's no difference in safety or efficacy between that sustained release and other sustained releases. How much were those prescription claims when they came through? That magic number of $17,000 again for a 90-day supply. Before we found that and caught that, it cost the university more than $500,000. And again, we had to pay that. Our PBM didn't catch it. The drug company charged it. And pharmacists can't simply substitute another drug for that branded Glumetza because it doesn't have the same bioavailability profile. So there's no easy way in the system to solve this problem. Again, $17,000 for a drug that should have cost us $50 is unconscionable. The piece de la resistance caught me, though, about 2 or 3 months ago. I always track and look at what are the highest cost individual claims that come through. We had a claim for one dose, one amount of the drug for Acthar Gel for $160,000 for one time. And this patient may have to use it over and over and over. $160,000. This is a drug that's been on the market since the 1950s. This is a drug that costs less than $100 in the past. It costs less than $1,000 in the past. Now it was $160,000 for this dose. And this is a drug that there isn't an alternative. There isn't another drug we can take and give to our patient. We value our employees at the university. We want to provide a good health benefit. We want to use wisely the resources you as a legislature give us at the university. But when we have unconscionable prices like this, we can't use those resources as wisely as we should. Knowing what I know about the pharmaceutical market and drug benefits and drug prices, what troubles me even more is there are going to be Zegrids and Glumetzas and Acthar gels in the state employee health plan. They're going to be in the Medicaid managed care program. They're going to be in the Medicare Part D program. We, as citizens and taxpayers, are paying through many programs that our state well supports, but we're paying unconscionable prices. We need to stop that. So the question I'll close with, I understand the questions about we don't want to stifle innovation, but the companies marketing these three products aren't looking for new innovative drugs. None of them have found new molecular entities and brought them to the market. These are companies simply taking capital out of the market, and I would argue this hurts innovation. This hurts the companies that are truly seeking the new therapeutic advance, and it takes capital out of a market and away from both the public and from the companies who are responsibly looking for new drug therapies. I think this hurts innovation.
Thank you for your testimony. Let me just say before we go on that I sit on Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and Dr. Shondemeyer did a presentation today that was very educational, very informative, and I only wish that this Health and Human Services policy had an opportunity to hear your presentation around price gouging. And just this statement before us is really unconscionable, and I just thank you for your insight, what's really taking place. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Shondemeyer. Just to kind of clarify, because I just have no idea why this would have happened. In the first two instances with the two drugs, were the patients given something that the doctor didn't prescribe, or was that specifically what the doctor prescribed? And so there's like this, promotion of one drug that's maybe, the latest and greatest in name brand, but like you say, there's just a biocarbonate, release change or difference, Madam Chair.
Dr. Shondemeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for that good question. We don't know for sure what was prescribed. My first reaction would be to say it was Zegrid. It's a brand name. If the doctor prescribes a brand name and says dispense as written, the pharmacist can't give them anything else, and we can't ask the patient. The patient gets the drug that was prescribed. With Glumetza, that's also a brand name, and there's no generic equivalent to Glumetza. There are other sustained-release metformins, but they have that different bioavailability profile. What really caught me, though, out of this, I noticed that the company who makes the Glumetza now markets a generic, and they market it's a single-source generic because you can only substitute it for Glumetza, and it only costs $12,000. For a 90-day supply, so they gave us a discount.
What a bargain. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
So before we go, continue on, this committee ends at 4 o'clock, and we are past 4 o'clock, but we have the room until 9 o'clock, and I would like to see this bill, let's make a decision about this bill. So we're going to continue on as long as we need to have each and every person ask the question that they need and allow the testifiers to speak on behalf of the questions that you have. So we're going to proceed. Representative Pearson.
Yeah, and actually, thank you, Madam Chair. So that tying in the generic actually feeds a little bit of the second question anyway, because you mentioned the third drug that's only available through one source. It's $160,000 for a single dose. The patent would have run out on that by now, and so if someone else wanted to step into the stream of commerce for that drug, they could actually produce that drug and sell it for $100,000 and probably be in a pretty profitable circumstance. Madam Chair.
Dr. Shondemeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for that. Again, a good question. That question comes up a lot, like with the Daraprim. Why hasn't somebody else come in to market that? Or with EpiPen, why doesn't somebody else market an equivalent of EpiPen? It takes a long time to get FDA approval, even for a generic drug. It can take 2 to 5 years. So even if I see someone selling a drug for $160,000 and I say, hey, I can do that for $80,000, you can't just start doing that next week. It would take 2 to 5 years at least. And then often in drug markets, for example, the drug, the Acthar Gel, has a very, very small market of patients who need it. And so there's not enough volume there probably to support two competitors in the market. It's not because it costs a lot to make it. There's just not enough volume to support two companies operating efficiently and competing in the market. So the structure of the pharmaceutical market just makes it different than virtually any other market we have.
Representative Pearson.
So earlier, when you were talking about that specific medication being a lot less expensive, were there additional uses years ago that made it more necessary to produce a large quantity of it, and so it was a scale of economics? Or, you know, again, I'm not here to defend pharmaceutical companies at all, but you know, if you're only making dosage for 1,000 patients in a year, that cost per dose is clearly going to be higher. And you know, I'm just trying to get to the root of where all of this is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Sean DeMeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, thank you, Representative, for a good question. That isn't what drives the cost. In fact, the company now, first of all, the company that sells it now didn't discover it, didn't bring it to market, didn't do the R&D to bring it to the market. They don't have the sunk cost that normally, R&D is usually a sunk cost that's 5 to 15 years in advance. You put the cost in and then you allocate it back to products later on. This company doesn't have that. Secondly, the drug now has about 15 or 20 different indications. It has more indications now than it did back when it was selling for much less. I haven't looked at the market volume of how many patients or how many scripts per year are out there for it, but it actually has more defined uses now than it did 20 and 30 years ago. So that doesn't explain the difference.
I'm learning a lot, Madam Chair, and I could probably ask questions all afternoon. I really appreciate your candid answers, and it gives us some perspective on all of this. Even that factored in the sunken costs, someone makes an investment in that operation, and tomorrow the FDA could come out with something that wipes that investment out by having something that's the better opportunity as well. And so in some ways, I definitely understand, and I guess the concerns I have with the discussion are these vague terms like unconscionable the description of unconscionable gets defined as being unreasonable or, you know, reasonableness. And that's not very specific either. And so those are actually my real concerns with the bill, and I just do think we need to get to the root of where these costs are coming from and how to get a competitive market.
Dr. Shandemeyer, can you speak to where the costs are coming from?
Again, sometimes companies have real costs. They have research and development costs. They have cost of production. They have shortage. They have to build a new plant. They have to deal with security and terrorism costs. There are all kinds of things that can be real costs. But also, there are some companies who consciously look for products that they call undervalued. That is, it's selling for less than I think I can get for it in the market, and they go in and buy the rights to a product. They don't have any research and development operation. They're not intending to discover new drugs. They're simply there to take capital out of the market. I'm all for entrepreneurism. I'm all for the market system. But I don't think it's right if people are taking capital out of the healthcare system and away from companies. I fully support a company if they have a bona fide research and development operation. They're looking for new innovative drugs. I don't criticize that at all. But if there are companies who are simply taking capital out of the market, don't have any bona fide research and development operation, looking for new innovative therapies, you can't justify that with research and development costs.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm happy to wait till the test fries are done, or I can go now, whatever your preference is.
Okay, let's wait. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schondelmeyer, in your years of experience, have you seen often reasons, or do you know of any reasons, why a drug would increase their price by 15% in a year for reasons other than increasing profits? And if so, can you give some examples?
Dr. Schondelmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, there may be bona fide reasons to raise their price more than 15%. Again, they may be getting their drug prepared by the raw materials prepared by a plant in China or in India. And I don't know if you remember in India, there was the Bhopal accident where a chemistry plant blew up. And if their drug was being produced there, suddenly they are without a source of supply and they have to go find a new source of supply. And that well could cost them 20-50% more for a period of time to resource the drug, to redevelop a plant, to get the operation. Or you may be aware there are a lot of drugs that are in shortage today. A lot of those are injectable medications. And there are many reasons for that. I won't try to solve the drug shortage problem today. We have other problems. But I will say that a lot of the drug shortage is injectable problems, and a lot of it is because the companies who make those injectables have been sort of pressured down in terms of competition to lower and lower prices, and they really haven't invested in their manufacturing facilities for injectable plants. And so they may at some point have to rebuild a plant, and that could warrant or justify a 20, 30, 50%. Again, but show me the evidence. I'm originally from Missouri, the show me state. You know, show me. You can convince me, and I'm not against believing the truth, but show me where the costs went. Show me a plausible, and that's a plausible reason, and there are others.
Representative Maine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in your experience, does that happen more often, or does price increases for the sake of profit happen more often?
Can you say?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I wouldn't speculate. I would say it's happened often enough that I would say it's not a rare event today to have prices go up for price reasons rather than cost reasons. There are cost reasons why prices go up, but it doesn't justify the patterns we see with drug prices today.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schondelmeyer, a couple questions. What would you deem to be a justifiable profit margin?
Dr. Schondelmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. I wouldn't attempt to define that setting here today. I think one can look at benchmarks, one can look at yardsticks, one can look at risk investment. There are a number of tools that one, either as an accountant or an economist or a finance person, could define to look at profit margins and reasonable profit margins. So there are reasonable things that one could do. I wouldn't try to define that sitting here today.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. But candidly, though, Doctor, what you're supporting is a piece of legislation that basically does attempt to do that very thing by suggesting to the private enterprise what is a justifiable profit margin for their doing business in the state of Minnesota. And I'm not here to, you know, make excuse for some of the outlandish, you know, price increases that we've all heard about. That's not the point. But I think what we're doing is we're suggesting that the AG's office, along with the commissioner of DHS and a few others, have the wherewithal to decide what's best for private industry to provide their product into the state of Minnesota. Would you agree that there is an inference of that in this bill?
Is that Schondelmeyer or Representative Lesh?
I'm sorry. Can you restate the question, Representative Albright? An inference of what?
Inference of a unilateral decision-making process that comports to justifying profit margin on pharmaceuticals, or as an outgrowth of that, I'm sure, any type of health care delivered in the state of Minnesota in the years to come.
Well,
Representative,
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, no. The bill states unconscionable.
And to the extent that would make a pharmaceutical company nervous, I don't think that's a bad thing. Because at the end of the day, it's going to be left up to a jury, and a jury is going to have to decide that. And I would say we are well on the other side of the 50-yard line as to whom we should give the benefit of the doubt due to the exorbitant increases of certain drug prices. I don't think there should be a loud squawking about, hold on a second, because I disagree with you that there's a bright line. There's not a bright line in this bill. It says unconscionable. That it's not particularly solid. And if you're a pharma company and said, well, now that makes us nervous that it is unclear, I would say that there are plenty areas of law where things are unclear. I just had a case last week, intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's defined by the courts as something that would cause someone to say, that's outrageous. That's your clear standard there. So there are plenty of areas of law that we do leave it to juries to decide whether something crosses a bright line or their line based on circumstances.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I think you proved my point from the standpoint of two factors. One, I think the Attorney General should probably beef up his request before state government finance for his budget because of an anticipation of litigation coming his way, not only from the feds on this matter under the Commerce Clause, but also from any number of private enterprises that are saying, how can you then suggest that we would want to do business in the state of Minnesota? If this is the temperament of the legislation that you're proposing, why would a drug company or a PBM under threat of litigation for not knowing what unconscionable is want to do business in the state of Minnesota to the point that they would retrace step and leave the state, leaving our citizens without the very medications you suggest they so desperately need, to the testimony of Ms. Nyman, when they need to take care of their patients and some of the very drugs that are predicated on saving the lives of their patients might not be available because of the threats that are imposed or inferred in this legislation. Medical companies won't do business in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, let them say that. Let pharma say, we're going to pull out of Minnesota because Minnesota won't let us earn obscene profits on the backs of sick people. I invite the day that I see that statement made at this table, in the press, or anywhere else. And I will tell you right now that if they come forward and say, well, and by the way, let's mark this day in the legislative record that Republicans want, are inviting federal intrusion into Minnesota's ability to protect its people. I don't mean to get personal, Representative Albright. I like you on that. However, it is a little bit ironic that we would be hearing that from the Republican side of the aisle, my friends over there, that we want to invite federal overreach into the state's ability to protect its folks. So I got a little rhetorical there, but that's me, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
To the bill.
And Representative Lesh. The inference was more of an observation, not an invitation, and you know full well where I was coming from. Our position on this has always been that we want to make sure that the patient or the citizen of the state of Minnesota is front and center in any piece of legislation, make sure that for the sake of them that they are afforded health care that is deemed necessary and appropriate. Where we differ is in terms of the definitions, unconscionable, unreasonable, the relief from DHS, from rulemaking, some of these other things. What it infers to me is that to some extent, and I certainly invite your consideration or observation on this, it almost sounds like you want to run the pharmacological industry in the state of Minnesota much like a PUC, where a board decides what prices are deemed appropriate and the pharmacy comes to you and says, we need to raise our prices, and so therefore you're entrenching, rather than inviting more competition, you're entrenching the players currently in the state. Why wouldn't they want to stay then if you're under a PUC model? Because they know they are fixed on what their prices are, and every year they come to you and say, we need to raise prices. Unconscionable or not, you tell us what we're going to make, and that's what it is. You just put a chilling effect on competitive juices, competitive forces in the state of Minnesota for innovation.
So we have three individuals on the list. Representative Pearson, is the question to Dr. Sunder Myers?
Nope, I was actually going to withdraw.
Okay, thank you. Representative Newt, is it to the testifier?
No, but it's pertinent to the current discussion.
Okay. And Chair Liebling, is your question to the?
I can wait, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. So we're going to release the testifier. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I apologize because I'm going to revisit this because I've read through the language multiple times, and so I'm hoping I can get some clarification from nonpartisan staff. I am reading Subdivision 2 with the definitions completely separate from Subdivision 5, which provides for the notification to the Attorney General. So I guess I'm looking for clarification from the nonpartisan staff on your read. Are new drugs, which have never been priced in the state of Minnesota, could those new drugs also be held to this unconscionable price standard?
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative New, I think it is sort of two different parts. So there's a definition of what an unconscionable price is, and the AG's office can take action. Part of the computation, I guess, under unconscionable price is whether or not your selling price, you know, accurately reflects the costs, say, of drug development and other related costs. Then there is the reporting that you mentioned in Subdivision 5. I think that even without, say, this 15% reporting, the bill does give the AG the authority to take action. So, you know, one way of viewing Subdivision 5 is it's sort of a notification for the AG and other parties that, you know, this perhaps is a drug you may want to take a look at regarding the unconscionable price definition. Regarding the question of whether it would apply to new drugs, I think once you have a new drug on the market and there's a price, you'd have a price to compare to the cost of development and other factors. So, I think under this bill, you could apply an analysis of a conscionable price to a relatively new drug, as long as there's pricing of the drug.
Representative New.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps to Representative Lesch. So what I'm hearing is that this actually indeed could be applied to new-to-market medications without a previous price comparison. So I actually think the premise of the bill, the 15% increase, I think we're all with you on these exorbitant increases. It is unconscionable. I'm a little concerned, however, about the scope of this particular bill and the scope of this language. So I guess, and I don't know if perhaps nonpartisan staff or Representative Lesch, if you know, are the costs of development and those other factors, is that currently public information? Is there a way that the Attorney General can simply look at this and make that comparison and choose to move forward with action?
Madam Chair and Representative New, this would be complaint-based. So first of all, the bill authorizes the Commission on Human Services to keep a list of essential drugs. And the way that those drugs would get on there would be based upon evaluation in the first place. So that would be one way. And then I'm presuming the commissioner would be keeping track of the market prices of those drugs. Short of that, that's not the only way that a cause of action can be begun by the Attorney General under this. I mean, someone could come and say, hey, my
my insulin went from $50 to $700, and that would be another way that you could make a claim and say that this is unconscionable. To the extent that you think that's certainly not the intent of the bill, that it would going from zero to $100 would be because there was no drug price before. I don't think that's what the bill does. To the extent that you do think that, Representative New, I mean, I would entertain an amendment to make that clear.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesch. I appreciate that because I know often intent versus language really matters, and I think certainly we want this language to be clean. I don't know that we want that broad of latitude in the hands of one person. And particularly in regards to this definition of unconscionable, I'm very concerned that given that this really can be applied to new-to-market pharmaceuticals, unconscionable is a subjective word. And in the bill, it is then further defined as reasonable, which is another subjective word. So I'm just very concerned about the latitude that we're giving the Attorney General's office, and even this idea that, you had mentioned that it is complaint-based. I don't think that's clear in the language. I don't think the language indicates that it is complaint-based. It seems to me that the language indicates that the Attorney General can choose to monitor this and make inquiries as he wishes, which is certainly concerning. Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative New, I would state again that the Attorney General's office is not a state agency under the umbrella of the executive branch. He is independently elected. He's an attorney. And if you have concerns about all the stuff that the Attorney General can do, I would invite you to read that section 8.1. Is it 8.16? I don't know where it is. 8.31, that allows investigation of offenses against provision of certain designated sections and assistant enforcement. That is a laundry list of a whole lot of things that the Attorney General can determine what he or she wants to do or what he does not want to do. And in order to do that, he cannot unilaterally do that. And I have some concerns over the suggestion that he's a one-man show and can decide what's right and what's wrong. All he can do is bring a court case. And, yeah, it is intimidating to be a company and get a letter from the Attorney General that the Attorney General is investigating you and looking at your stuff. But it's a judge and a jury that make the decision as to whether or not you cross the line. I just do want to make that clear that the Attorney General isn't king here. He's just an attorney that has the authority as prescribed by statute that's been since statehood.
Okay, so we have two more testifiers.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. I don't disagree. I just think this bill is expansive, and we should probably be cautious about that, and I appreciate the thorough vetting that you are giving this, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is Brett Michelin? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and, for the record, tell us who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Brett Michelin. I'm with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the generic and biosimilar manufacturers. Please bear with me. There's been a lot of discussion, so I'm going to try and truncate my comments here. So if it's a little chopped up, I apologize for that. But we do want to. I know you want to move along in the committee. The generic biosimilar, just to give you a little bit of scale, generic and biosimilar manufacturers make about 61 billion doses of medications every year. I'd like to recognize that off the bat that we appreciate a little bit of the change in the focus of this bill. Before the amendments today, it was squarely on generics and off-patent drugs. Again, we just represent the generic and biosimilar industry. And so we do believe that the amendments do actually start to focus the bill a little bit better on the real cost drivers in the pharmaceutical land. Thank you. Sorry. Generics in 2017 saved the state of Minnesota $3.8 billion and saved the United States as a whole $265 billion. 90% of all prescriptions are filled with generic drugs, but only 23% of the cost. That means we take only 23% of the revenue of the total drug spend, filling 90% of prescriptions with generic drugs. I think one of the probably the issue of drug cost is a national discussion, and a lot of states are trying to address it in different ways. One of the first states to implement a drug transparency law is the state of California, and it actually just came out with a report in December. And I'd like to report a little bit on what was found there. Of the 25 most frequently prescribed generics, they were about 39.9% of the total prescriptions, 4.8% of the total revenue, less than 0.3% of insurance premiums could be attributed to the 25 most frequently prescribed generic drugs. The total annual spend for generics was $1.34 per person per month. Of the most expensive generic drugs, 25% of all drugs prescribed, 8% of the spend. Less than 1% of insurance premiums could be attributed to the most expensive generics. The highest year-over-year price increases for generic drugs are only 4.7% of the total spend on prescriptions. It's been referenced that this bill is based on a bill that was passed in Maryland that it did become law. The governor at the time had refused to sign it and was ultimately has been declared unconstitutional by the Federal Circuit Court, as was mentioned earlier. I'd like to just bring up probably five quick points, again, that somewhat have been raised, but that address AAM's concerns with the bill. And it is, number one is the use of vague terms. It prohibits unconscionable prices and defines unconscionable as not justified. For manufacturers who are trying to do the right thing and trying to react within the marketplace, those aren't clear terms, and they don't give good direction on what is justified and what is not. Second, generic medications are sold on a national level, on a national scale, and not in a state or specific region. In fact, three wholesalers purchase 90% of all generic drugs, and then they determine where those drugs are going to be distributed. We don't control the distribution of the drugs once they've been turned over to those three wholesalers. That is why the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that this similar law in Maryland violated the Dormant Commerce Clause and invalidated that law. I think one thing that needs to be mentioned is one of the differences in the generic supply chain is once we sell to those three wholesalers, we're out of the game. We don't control increased prices after that point. Every entity within the supply chain, from the manufacturer to the patient, has the opportunity and does increase the price of drugs. So not all price increases are the result of the manufacturer, especially in the generic space. The thresholds in the bill will capture inexpensive drugs that are not what's driving up the cost of health care. As was mentioned, it uses the $80 WAC floor, wholesale acquisition cost floor, for the essential prescription drugs. It can capture drugs that cost $2.60 a day. For many prescriptions, where a pill happens to be taken three times a day, that's an 89-cent pill. Fourth, the bill requires the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the Commissioner of Human Services, and any health plan to notify the Attorney General of any 15% increase in 1 year. The generic market is like a commodities market. Our prices fluctuate up and down with almost every sale. And with those constant price fluctuations, we don't believe that provision and the inclusion of 15% adequately
recognizes what occurs within the generic market. We don't want to actually disincentivize a generic manufacturer from lowering costs if they're going to be penalized when the price of the drug does go up. Again, they go up, they go down. 15% can be calculated in many different ways. If a drug drops by 4%, goes up by 2%, should that count as a 2% increase or a 2% decrease in the total cost of the drug? The other aspect of having drugs actually increase, I believe, was also addressed earlier, and that encourages additional manufacturers to get back into the market. Many generic manufacturers can have portfolios with hundreds to even 1,000 drugs. They're not producing each one of those drugs all the time. They will enter and exit a market quite regularly. And it's the incentive of the price going up at times that will bring additional manufacturers back into the market and then brings the price back down. Fifth, this bill allows for a private right of action, and that causes great concern amongst manufacturers. Essentially, this allows nearly anyone to bring a lawsuit that against a manufacturer for a drug that they feel is an unconscionable price increase. And again, it's the vague use of the terms from the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions if I glossed over something too quickly or any specifics on the bill as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Christina Moorhead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Christina Moorhead, and I'm a Senior Director of State Policy for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. We represent the country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical researchers, and we've invested more than $600 billion since 2000 in the search for new life-saving and life-improving treatments and cures. Our biopharmaceutical companies agree that our healthcare system is not working. Far too many patients struggle to afford or have access to healthcare, including their prescription medicines. We think that's wrong, we think it's unfair, and we think it needs to change. While medical innovation has made the U.S. a world leader in the discovery of new medicines, these treatments won't benefit patients if patients can't get them. But likewise, this bill, which has price controls in them, won't allow our companies to make those medicines for patients either. Before I discuss this particular amendment, I want to provide some important context on the challenges that patients are facing. Last year, spending on medicines grew just 0.6%, and net prices grew just 1.5%, according to data from IQVIA. This growth is less than overall inflation. The slowdown in spending and in prices is partially due to rebates and discounts increasing. Our company's average rebate, 40 cents for every dollar spent on a brand medicine back to the supply chain and other entities. We see pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, and hospitals are getting billions of dollars every year from these rebates or from programs like 340B. And last year, these rebates totaled more than $150 billion. But instead of using those rebates to lower what patients pay for medicines, those funds are often used to pad their bottom lines, lower premiums, or fill other holes in their budgets. The insulin market is actually a good example of how rebates and discounts are not benefiting patients. Negotiated discounts and rebates and other price concessions can lower the list price of insulin by 70% and more. In fact, in most Medicaid programs, you're paying very minimal, and sometimes our manufacturers are giving insulin for free to Medicaid programs due to the federal rebate statute. However, payers have increasingly included medicines in the health plan deductible or subjected them to coinsurance, and that exposes patients to the undiscounted list price of drugs. So as you can see, the incentives in our system are misaligned, and they're not benefiting patients. And so we need to address the way that medicines are paid for, including making sure that patients are not paying more for their medicines than their insurer. And so while well-intended, the proposed amendment does not address the issue of what a patient pays for a prescription medicine. It ignores the reality that health insurers and not biopharmaceutical manufacturers determine the price a patient pays out of pocket for a prescription medicine. The federal government recognized this issue last week with a new proposed rule that would allow for prescription drug discounts to be offered directly to Medicare patients, and we agree that this proposal will help to fix the misaligned incentives that currently result in insurers and PBMs favoring medicines with higher list price in order to profit off of those rebates. Finally, we have a couple legal concerns with this amendment because federal patent law preempts any provision that would interfere with the pricing of patented pharmaceutical drugs, biologics, or devices. Previously, it was said that this bill corrects four challenges from the Maryland case. They did not mention the District of Columbia case where the City Council passed a price control in 2005 that defined what excessive prices meant. Three different courts struck down that D.C. law through a legal process that went up to the Federal Circuit Court. And in summary, the legal reasons these courts struck down the D.C. price control law is that state price controls on patented prescription drugs changed the balance that Congress set in federal law through the Hatch-Waxman Act. And we've already talked about the Maryland case today. I wanted to talk just about one more thing about the issue of whether or not this would apply to new medicines. And our interpretation of this would be under Subdivision 2, when you identify a drug as essential, and then you determine that that price is unconscionable, you then move to Subdivision 3, which prohibits a drug manufacturer from charging an unconscionable price for an essential medicine. And so we would interpret that to apply to new medicines. And so we believe that this would apply to a drug that was entering the market. Oftentimes, the company announces what that price is going to be shortly before that drug comes to market. So in closing, we appreciate and we applaud the commitment of the committee to address the high out-of-pocket costs patients pay face when paying for their medicines. We have some serious legal concerns with this amendment. We think there are better policies out there to ensure lower prices for patients.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moorhead, thank you for your testimony. So I'm wondering then, since you read this the same way I do, so my question, I'm not sure that I really got an answer to this before. Is the cost of research and development and bringing a drug to market, is that currently public information?
So some of it is. Our manufacturers file FTC filings, mm-hmm. but it's difficult to determine exactly what research and development goes into which drug. Often the research and development process may lead you one way and then it leads you to another way. You may discover something over here that then later is used for a drug over here. So it's actually very difficult to determine what the research and development costs are for one specific drug. I'd like to also add that actually only 12% of our prescription drugs that go into clinical trials actually make it to market. It's not a great percentage, but that's our reality. And so we also need to recoup for the research and development for prescription drugs that actually never make it to market. And so somehow those costs have to be included, too, so we can continue to create new drugs.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I assume your read is similar to mine, then, of this language that, like I said, the scope is very broad. And we don't know what those definitions would be to determine whether or not that price is unconscionable. It's hard to even know what the actual costs of research and development are. So how in the world do we determine unconscionable? It's very, very subjective. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. One moment, please, Ms. Moorhead.
Chair Liebman. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Moorhead, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name when you started. You were mentioning rebates, and I think you said that 40% of the price of drugs is given back in rebates. So my question to you is, why do you rebate at all? What is the purpose from the point of view of the manufacturer of doing the rebates?
So I believe it's 70% of the pharmaceutical benefits in America are managed by three pharmacy benefit managers. And for people in the commercial market, they just decide what drugs are on your formulary. And so our manufacturers are competing to be placed onto that formulary. Otherwise, the patients don't have access to our drugs. And so PBMs make more money usually when they use spread pricing. So what they look for is a high list price, and then you've got the rebate going down to the actual net price. And the more money that's in that spread price, the more money that the PBM makes off of that. So we've actually seen in the brand market, there's a good example with the hepatitis C drugs. We have multiple hepatitis C drugs that are all brand drugs. They're competing against each other. I think the third one came out with a lower list price, and that drug was not preferred over the first two that came out because the other two were offering greater rebates. So really it's our companies competing against each other to be on those formularies in the first place. and then also being driven to provide greater rebates. That's why we think policies like what the federal government announced this past week, we have policies that could work on a state level, but we really want to delink those middlemen from profiting off that spread pricing. They do provide value. They should be reimbursed, but we think that that would be better probably on a fee basis instead of the spread pricing basis.
Well, thank you. You know, I mean, that's interesting. We had a presentation in our last committee this afternoon about some of this, and it is very, very complicated. But I do support the bill. You know, the problem is this is a little bit like whack-a-mole, right? There are a lot of different parts of this problem, and there's never going to be a perfect bill where we're going to get at everything in one bill. And listening to the discussion here, I think that in the industry there's a little bit of a, it reminds me of that old saying of people say, don't tax him, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree, right? This is a little bit like that. Don't regulate him, don't regulate me, regulate the guy behind the tree. Well, you know, I get it that the manufacturers are only one part of the problem, but... Well, you know, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm under the impression that pharmaceutical manufacturers are doing very well as an industry.
I think it depends on which company.
I'm
sorry.
I really need you to go through the chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Ms. Moorhead.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative, I think it depends on what company you look at. We have companies who are consolidating. We have companies going out of business. There are a lot of more venture capitalist companies that never make it. I think we hear a lot of the good stories and not the bad. That's where we come to. Only 12% of our drugs make it to market. That surprises a lot of people.
Chair Liebling. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you. I appreciate, you know, getting information from you this afternoon. But, you know, I think that this is a health committee, first of all. It's not the Commerce Committee. In this committee, in the health committee, we worry about the health of Minnesotans. We don't worry about what's good for the industry. I heard a member earlier say, you know, they were concerned this isn't about, this isn't what's best for the industry. And I'm with Representative Leshear. I don't think this is about what's best for the industry. I think this has to be about what's best for Minnesotans. Now, I get it that we need to have manufacturers, we need to have research and all that. I do not look at this bill as being all that onerous a thing to do. Just be able to look at some of these drugs. This doesn't require the AG to sue anybody. It sets up a conversation. It gives authority in cases where the AG determines that the threshold is met. But I think this is actually a pretty reasonable place to start. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moorhead, isn't it true that American pharmaceutical companies profit over $500 billion per year?
Mrs. Moorhead.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know that fact for sure, but I'm happy to look it up and get that for you.
Well, it's also true. Sorry, Madam Chair. It's also true that pharmaceutical companies have greater than 40% profit margin, which is the highest profit margin than any industry in America. Do you know those numbers?
Ms. Moyet.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't, but we were happy to look into. I think you're looking at maybe an average. If you know where you got those numbers from, I'd love to see that, and we'd love to get back with you on that as well. Thank you.
Representative Mann. All right. Thank you. Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mann, you might also check. I think the diamond industry probably has a better profit margin than the pharmaceutical industry. I have a jeweler who shares with me his profit margin, so we might not have a conversation about that. Representative Lesh. It appears in the conversation and the testimony that we've been provided with that the PBMs play a very central and integral role in price setting. Would your piece of legislation take into consideration PBMs and or wholesalers as it would construe to price setting for the drugs that are provided in the state of Minnesota to our citizens.
Representative Lash?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. It takes into account manufacturers, okay? As far as the kind of three-card money of how prices occur between manufacturers and what consumers actually pay, I think that's one of those things that, has to be fall under the unconscionable standard. So, yes, I would say that it would, because ultimately it's human beings that have to decide whether or not this price is unconscionable, and they would take all that into consideration.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, on page 8 of the bill, you have placed a severability clause in the language itself, and presumably that is to protect against any litigation that would, to my earlier point, render some of the provisions in this bill moot under the Commerce Clause. So for just conjecture's sake alone, let's just say that the bill was found to be unconstitutional, or provisions of it unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause. You invoke the severability clause, then the remaining piece of the bill that stands would be the list of essential prescription drugs. What purpose does that list then function as going forward?
Representative Flash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, you're presuming that would be the only section that would survive any constitutional challenge if, in fact, parts of the statute were struck down. The function of the essential drug list is to give notice if one of those increases unconscionably. So what purpose would it serve? I don't know. I couldn't speculate. They may find another purpose for it. But my purpose for it in drafting this is to give notice that if these things are you know, if it's a psoriasis drug, it's going to be very different than the need is for, like, let's say, a life-saving blood pressure medication or something like that.
Finally, then, right. Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, on page 9, I note that the effective date for the bill itself is curious in terms of turns back time. To July 1st, 2014, so a five-year look-back rule. Somewhat uncharacteristic in legislation that we put forward in terms of proactive looking forward. You're actually providing for kind of a look-back or review of all pricing for all drugs in the state of Minnesota for 5 years. I'm just looking for an explanation in terms of the rationale for the look-back provision.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Albright, in certain instances, remember this is not criminal, right? So there's no prohibition of ex post facto laws, which I presume you know. But in terms of in civil law, when we decide to apply, change anything, statutes of limitations, statutes of repose, applying effective dates retroactively, we mess around with those in certain instances. You may recall when we, by a pretty large margin, approved a 30-year look-back period for cases of child sex abuse for civil suits. And that was because of extreme shenanigans and chicanery with respect to people hiding evidence and hiding the ball on that. And so there have been some extraordinary price increases going back to 2014 that we should receive scrutiny, and if they succeed and they're found to be justified by a finder of fact, so be it. But we thought that going back 5 years was appropriate in this case, just because of the increases that have occurred in the last 5 years.
So, Madam Chair, just then commentary, by enacting this with that retroactive ability, materially, then you're putting every pharma, every PBM, every wholesaler, every distributor that does business in the state of Minnesota to freeze and retain all records incumbent upon the preparation or dissemination of a drug in the state of Minnesota for the last 5 years. That would be a truthful statement.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I'm not sure I'd characterize it that way.
I think that if I were a pharmaceutical company, I would tell my people to say, hey, go back and look again and find out if we can justify these increases in the last 5 years. I don't know if any of you have put a parent into long-term care, but I can guarantee you the federal government looks to see if you've been squandering assets in the period leading up to when you put them in a nursing home to put the bill for your parent on the taxpayers instead of something they could afford. It's not uncommon, and in this case, we're applying that same kind of standard to pharmaceutical manufacturers.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Lesh.
All right, thank you. So is there anyone else in the audience who wish to testify on House File 4? Is there any discussion from the committee? Representative Pearson.
I would like to offer the amendment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm offering the A1 amendment, trying to narrow the scope of this rather broad bill. Again, as I look over, as I stated earlier, you know, the definitions that are in here are, you know, typical. It depends law school type of material, and it's really fascinating to see the way that the bill is crafted. So I guess I'm trying to narrow that in scope. You know, the unconscionable price definitions are just simply too broad, and what we're really going after is trying to fix what the patients can afford. And, you know, the first testifier, is that with AARP, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
Second.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, second testifier, excuse me, sure. Mr. Phillips, over and over again, if he's got a printed copy of his remarks, the number of times he said affordability, and that's, I think, what most people are trying to get at here, and I think that's what your bill is going after as well, Representative Lesh. And so I guess I'm trying to offer this as a friendly amendment in recognizing that we don't want frivolous lawsuits coming from the Attorney General's office. That's not your goal or our goal. Just because that, you know, he thinks something's unconscionable or unreasonable, you know, there's such a broad spectrum that can be applied to, but what we really want to do is actually protect Minnesotans from drug prices they cannot afford. So this amendment ensures that this bill's intent is to protect Minnesotans and not just to attack an industry to make political points. We're really trying to save lives, and that's what this policy committee should be about, and I would ask for member support and hope the author would accept the amendment.
Representative Lesh, do you have any comments to the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, I don't know you that well. I don't think we've ever served on a committee together, and you don't talk that much on the floor, so I don't know your personality, what your motivations are, what you do that well. But when I first saw this amendment, I thought, are you serious? You want to ensure that someone has to suffer or die for the Attorney General to take a look at whether or not the drug price gouging was responsible for this. Do you really want to do that? I mean, Madam Chair, you know, if you really want to have this amendment up, Representative Pearson, and maybe, you know what, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm mistaking your motivations here and you really are trying to make this better. But, and, this is a conjunctive phrase, and, the price is so high that it limits patient access to the essential drug, resulting in patient suffering or death. Go ahead and offer that, and I hope someone asks for a roll call. But I oppose it.
Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Representative Lesh said that very well. I mean, I'm frankly appalled at this amendment that we would say that you know, before the Attorney General can look at this, it has to be something that results in patient suffering or death. I wonder if Representative Pearson could explain to us what it means, what he means by suffering. How do you define suffering? Is that like where you broke your leg or where your leg has to be amputated, or exactly when are you suffering, Representative Pearson?
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, this is actually talking about the limiting the patient's access. And so the causation that it would create, it's the limitation. So we're not actually saying a person would have to die from or have suffered extreme pain. It's the limitation in patient's access. And Mr. Lush, the attorney, I believe that's what the language is in fact stating.
Well, Madam Chair, that's not how I read it, and I would like us to have a roll call on this, Madam Chair, because I think this is pretty appalling that we would, want to do this. And I don't know. When it's so high, it limits patient access to the essential drug, resulting in patient suffering or death. I just think that we should take a roll call on this because I think it's important for us to show which side we're on. Okay.
So, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of confused by the wording that's used in the proposed amendment here because it's making the assumption that it's going to be based on a person's income. And the question is whose income are we going to use? I work with a lot of homeless people, so if you've got somebody who's homeless who's only got GA of $97 a month, does that mean the bottle of aspirin they may need to pick up at the store also becomes unaffordable and you can prosecute a company under that? Or are you taking a look at somebody who's got a moderate income, or are you taking a look at somebody who's got high income? It seems to me that we were talking earlier about definitions. I kind of have problems with, it says so high that it limits a person's access to essential drugs for life-saving. That's going to depend on what a person's income, and that's going to be all over the board. You could have, a million different answers depending who's taking the income, and you've got a wide-open thing that makes a bill that I think is pretty good right now just totally unworkable, or if it became law, every drug company would be subject to a lawsuit under this. So I would oppose this amendment the way it's written.
Representative Piper?
Yeah, and just to respond to the author of the amendment here, this isn't just about limiting access. I mean, the way this amendment provision is worded, it has to be so high that it limits patient access to the essential drug. That's true, it does say that, comma, but then it says, comma, resulting in patient suffering or death. So for this provision to become operative for the Attorney General to have this authority to investigate this, there has to be patient suffering or death. And I just don't see that as strengthening this bill. I think it weakens it. It puts people in a totally untenable position where they have to suffer or die before any of the provisions of this bill can become effective. So I'm certainly voting no.
So... roll call has been Representative Pearson.
Yeah, to these points, the rest of the language of the bill hasn't been stricken, so no, this is inserted within. So all of the other provisions still exist, and this is basically just kind of the extra guardrail that a person would need to, as has been mentioned, would need to have limited access. Affordability is certainly to the crux of this amendment. And again, we have a lot of people who are on great health insurance benefits, and these issues aren't coming up. But it's that access. It's the testimony of the gentleman who is limiting his use of diabetes medication and ended up losing his life. That's ultimately what we're trying to impose, is that threshold would be used here so that person would be given access.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our job is to prevent suffering and death. And so this language makes it seem like we won't act until there is suffering and death. So I think we are acting way after the fact, which makes this dangerous, counterproductive, and just generally not very good for patient care.
So a roll call has been requested. The clerk would take the roll. On the A1 amendments.
Chair Moran?
No.
Vice Chair Morrison?
No.
Minority Lead Keel? Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Backer? Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Edelson?
No.
Representative Fisher?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Loeffler? Representative Mann?
No.
Representative Pierce, I'm sorry, Representative New?
No.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Schultz?
So there have been two ayes and 11 noes. The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Any further discussion? Representative Pearson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I guess my question is to you. It's great to state that, you know, we've got unreasonable and unconscionable profits that are occurring in the state of Minnesota and in our country. Are you concerned at all with there being something between a profit of zero and a profit of unconscionable where pharmaceutical companies will make the choice not to move forward with a drug that is marketed within the state of Minnesota?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, I don't think we're even in the ballpark of having to make that speculative call at this point because of how tilted the playing field is in favor of the ability to unconscionably raise prices. So we're bringing this legislation because we have a major problem. If it turns out, and I don't think it will, but if it turns out that you're right, I can guarantee you there will be legislation to address that. But right now, the problem before us is that sick people can't get their medicine in certain instances because the prices are unconscionably high. That's what I'm trying to solve.
Just to follow up, you know, so again, if there is a miracle drug out there and it's brought into the market, do you think it's possible that the state of Minnesota could be an island that that drug is not available in because a drug company is concerned that that could trigger the lawsuit?
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, no. And I will restate to you what I said to Representative Albright. I invite that to be said by any company that we're not selling in Minnesota because they're not going to let us charge unconscionably high prices.
Madam Chair, that's a really cavalier statement to make. In my opinion, that seems bold to put that dare out there. When there could be people whose lives are definitely going to be impacted by that if it were to occur. And I don't understand how you can say that with such confidence. And for that reason, I really just cannot support this bill. And so I just wanted to ask you those questions and have you state that for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, any closing statements?
Sure, Madam Chair, and just to respond in part, Representative Pearson, speculating that people's lives could be affected because pharma is going to leave Minnesota an island ignores all this testimony of folks that sat right here. There's people who are dying now. There are people who are sick now. And it pains me to think that someone could skip over all those stories and say, wow, could we endanger people's lives if we tried to fix that? And that's fine. If you want to go in that direction, that's your prerogative. But I'm trying to fix a problem that we have now. And I would close just with two points, Madam Chair. One, to the extent that people are calling into question the legalities of what happened in Maryland. First, this is a different bill. This is not the Maryland bill. That was the Fourth Circuit that made that decision. We have a Supreme Court decision
that I don't think anyone on this committee sits on a tax committee, but that we're having to grapple with on the tax committee. It's called South Dakota v. Wayfair. And that decision was made on also Commerce Clause grounds that had reasoning that was completely different that people are citing here in the Maryland case that allowed a state to take certain actions with respect to the Wayfair case in its own interest. And in this case, it's the interest of public safety. So I think we are well poised to have a successful, constitutional, and fair bill. And the last thing I would say, Madam Chair, is folks remember when Mark Dayton beat Rod Grams in 2000. Everyone was talking about those trips that he took seniors on bus rides up to Canada so they could afford their drugs. Okay, people claim that was the reason why he beat Rod Grams in the 2000 election. I don't know if that's the reason why he won or not. But members, that was 19 years ago. 19 years. And in 19 years, this legislature has not found a way to fix that problem so that people won't get sick and won't die based on unconscionable prices. I think this bill is the way to go, and I ask for your support.
Is saying that, Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, I request a roll call vote on this bill.
Oh, thank you. All right, so if there are there any other comments? So a roll call has been requested on House File 4 as amended. The clerk would take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Yes.
Vice Chair Morrison?
Yes.
Minority Leader Keel? Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Backer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mann?
Yes.
Representative New?
No.
Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Schultz?
Okay, so we have 10 ayes and 5 nays. The motion prevails, and House File 4, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. Yay. And so, members, really quick, before we adjourn, I would like to announce that in addition to our normal committee time, we will be meeting next Monday in this room from 12:45 to 2:45 to take up a few bills related to long-term care. And the agenda has been sent out. Just want to thank everyone for this really robust conversation on this bill. And we will see you tomorrow. Thank you. We are adjourned.